right. That is our sound. So we get to get started with the Aging Well Together show. We have been off for a few weeks, and we're excited. So we're finally back in the studio. And such a great guest and a great show we have for you today. So I've been really looking forward to getting back, and I'm so excited to have my colleague and friend here, Michelle Rees, the president and CEO of the super impressive and important North Carolina Institute of Medicine. Michelle is going to share all about their work supporting the health of all North Carolinians, a huge task. We're going to learn all about that. I am so excited for that. But as always, before we dive into our show, we want to give a shout out to WCOM LP Chapel Hill Carrboro for hosting our weekly Aging Well Together show. You can catch our show every Thursday from 2 to 3 on 103.5 FM, or you can stream us live. That's how many people are listening to us right now, through WCOMFM.org. The Aging Well Together show is brought to you by the always helpful and fabulous team at the Orange County Department on Aging. Besides being our wonderful sponsors, and they are often expert guests on our show, each week the team, Marilyn Hoyle over there, she posts our previous shows on Orange County's website. So if you want to catch up on any of our past shows, or even find a range of local Orange County aging resources, you can go to Orange County Department on Aging's website. I'm trying to not talk too fast, even though Michelle and I were just chatting. I think she had decaf, but I drank a lot of, because she's smiling. I drank a lot of caffeinated tea, so I'm trying to watch my pace. So the Orange County Department on Aging's website, it is, that little chat was to give you time to get your pen and paper, orangecountync.gov/aging. We always highlight you need to do that orangecountync.gov, or you're going to find yourself in Orange County, California. And so on the website, you can hear all of our previous shows. Today is episode 84. And so lots of great podcasts for our shows to listen to. And if you don't want to go on the website, but you do want to talk with someone about any local resources, you can call our friends at the Orange County Department on Aging. And their number for the main number there is 919-968-2070. And if you have any questions about our shows or want to suggest a topic or person or organization, and I will say we just have a few slots left in 2025. Alicia will be here soon and she'll be excited to know we are now starting to schedule into 2026. But I love getting options and suggestions from our listeners. So please email me at, it's all one big email address, agingwelltogethershow@gmail.com, agingwelltogethershow@gmail.com. And you got to hear just a little bit of music from the wonderful Carrboro bass band, the Robert Bradford Quintet. Literally, you heard like 5 seconds. You will hear a lot more at the end of the show. We really appreciate their letting us use their great music and their original music, Mayfly, for our theme music. My fabulous co-host, Alicia Reed, is probably listening to us from the car. She is on the way over here. She'll be here in a few minutes. And so I'm excited that she'll be back. We haven't seen each other for weeks and we miss each other. And as you all know, Alicia is one of the extraordinary wellness instructors with the Orange County Department on Aging. She's a dedicated community volunteer, and she is also host of the show Right After Hours, Afternoon Talk with Alicia. So I know she'll come at some point because she needs to be on this microphone at 3 o'clock. So I'm excited to see her. And then as for me, I'm Heather Altman. I've spent over 25 years, I get to say 30 soon, in aging services and supports. Technically, I started at 14, so I could say 40 years, but I help help older adults and their families connect with resources in our community. I'm a caregiver for older family members, and at 54 for the next few weeks, since I'll be 55 soon, I am always focusing on my own changing needs. So I am super invested in how we are all aging well together. This show is as about you all, our listeners, as it is selfishly about me and things that I want to learn. And today's show is no exception. I'm really, really excited for our great guest this week. We have, as I said, Michelle Reese. She is all kinds of impressive. She is the president and CEO of the North Carolina Institute of Medicine, with over a decade at the NCIOM, as it's called. She has led key initiatives in health policy, including COVID-19 response efforts, task forces on serious illness care, which we will chat about because that's close to my heart, dementia, child well-being, and Medicaid reform. She also founded the Legislative Health Policy Fellows Program, supporting informed policymaking in North Carolina. She really is a true North Carolina leader and such a wonderful person. And so we're so excited to welcome, for the first time, to the Aging Well Together show, welcome Michelle Reese.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
Oh, look at that. Let's turn Michelle's microphone on. And you know who else's microphone we get to turn on? Alicia. Oh, you're four. All right. See? All right, your mic's on.
Hey,
hello. Hi, lovey.
Hi, Alicia. Good to meet you.
Hi.
I know. Alicia, Michelle, Alicia.
Nice to meet you.
I have missed you, friend, and to celebrate Michelle.
Hugs. I've missed her.
I know. We're big huggers. And just to celebrate Michelle's first time coming on the show and to celebrate you and I being back together after a month apart. Uh-oh. Michelle doesn't know this, but we're super obsessed with.
Yay. I love it.
Yay.
This is called fancy high tech. Mm-hmm. We try to have at least one experience where we can use our sound box. We got this about 10 shows ago. We got this as our Christmas Hanukkah present to ourselves. And it has not, we're not sick of it yet. Like, we still use it a lot.
We haven't used it, all the buttons.
I know, well, because some of the buttons are ridiculous. And I don't even understand some of the buttons. And there's no off button. And it's in my bag. And it constantly, like, there's a scream. And it's amazing when I walk and it gets set off. And all of a sudden you hear, like, what are we doing here? We only got it for this clapping the drum roll. All right.
Okay.
So I do like how we have one of the most impressive, thoughtful, analytical, just hardcore leaders in North Carolina, and we have now already tangent into scream machines. I promised her we were easygoing and lighthearted. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're going to talk all about the cool stuff at the, and I say cool in the most professional academic
cool.
policy
cool.
related
good,
term, because I have been impressed and following it for years, and it really is impressive. If I haven't known you for so long, I should be super intimidated. But before we get into all the things with, and we'll shorten it, listeners, to NCIOM every once in a while if you hear us.
Great.
We always like to know a little bit about you, like, and you and I have fun talking even before that, so I know some fun things, but tell us about you, where you're from, and how you even got connected with the NCIOM.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So I am relatively new to North Carolina. I am an alum of UNC Chapel Hill. I did go to university as an undergrad.
Go Tigers.
But I was not from North Carolina. I was from Virginia. So I came to North Carolina for those 4 years. I graduated. I went to New York City at that time because I actually was not involved in healthcare or health policy in any way. As you reminded me when we talked earlier, I was a dramatic arts major at the University of North Carolina.
Oh, so, Alicia, people and I was looking at her bio deciding what to say, I already told her, I'm like, I'm not going to ask about it, but you were dramatic arts, so go on.
So I brought it up myself, right? Okay. Right. So that was actually why I went to New York City originally, because I wanted to act and to produce plays and do all of that. So I did that for a little bit of time.
Open mouth. Looking.
Right. And I realized after about 4 or 5 years that profession was not really for me going forward. There was instability that was difficult for my personality and everything.
I get that.
I didn't know where the next job was coming from. It just was not quite for me. So I regrouped and tried to figure out what else I was interested in, what other, you know, sort of career path that I wanted. And I actually was a double major in undergrad and also majored in anthropology.
Saw that too.
And had a focus in medical anthropology. So I had several friends and colleagues and professors and so forth who had exposed me to sort of the field of public health and how it relates to anthropology, and said, huh, what are they doing? And so I went back to look at that, and I said, I'm very interested in that. I'd continued to do some volunteer work at clinics and things like that, so I'd kept sort of my finger on the pulse of some of those things, and said, well, I'm going to go back to school, get my master's in public health. I stayed in the city in order to do that, and then following my master's degree, I worked at an organization called the Commonwealth Fund out of New York City, which is a health policy foundation, looks at national policy, state policy. I actually worked in their international policy division. So we did, cross-comparative research between the United States and other developed countries saying, hey, we've got these aspects of our health system. We've got these sorts of outcomes. How are we, you know, connecting those two? What are you doing? How are your outcomes based on your you know, policy approaches? And so we brought people together to talk about a lot of those things. We did a lot of research and surveys and things like that to say, hey, what are the things that are really impacting people's ability to be healthy, both in the United States and in those other countries? So always really fascinating.
So cool. You know, I saw that really quickly, and then I was really just trying to focus on what you are currently doing. And we always have so much to talk about, because I also finished school, went to New York City, and but I decided not to go to Columbia and decided to come here to the School of Public Health at UNC. So that's what brought me down here. But the Commonwealth Fund, you've just impressive place to impressive place.
Yeah.
How'd you get from New York doing international work to North Carolina and local and state work?
Yeah, great question. So I didn't mention that when I was here in Chapel Hill, that's where I met my husband.
No. So I knew that. And so I was wondering if this might come back.
He is from North Carolina. Okay. He was born and raised in Kinston, North Carolina. So I took him with me to New York City.
No.
So, you know, and we got married and all of that. And we had two children while we were in the city. And once our youngest got to be a toddler and we had a tiny apartment, and we were taking children to daycare in taxis and strollers and baby carriers. And it was just a lot. And we didn't have grandparents nearby. We didn't have a yard. Help. And we said, we're going to go back to North Carolina. And so we actually were deciding between the Charlotte area and the Triangle area, and came down and visited sort of both and looked around and said, let's go back to the Triangle. We actually live in Raleigh. So
good
we are
decision.
There. Yeah, and we've since had a third child, so we have three now. We do have a yard. We do have grandparents nearby. It's wonderful.
It is different. We left New York and started. When you start thinking about I do have friends that stayed and to watch them navigate young children there, but it is a
one
big...
One was okay. Two became pretty darn tricky.
Yeah, it gets... Well, hey, New York's loss, our gain. And then,
you.
So you came down here. Did you immediately start working with the NCIOM? Because you've had lots of different. I did a quick introduction, but you've had it. You know, you've had over 10 years there doing kinds of cool.
I have. It wasn't immediate, but it was within the first year after we moved here. And really what my approach was because I had worked in international policy, I didn't really have much state health policy experience. I didn't really know much about Medicaid. I didn't really know much about, you know, how any state worked, and certainly didn't know specifically about the landscape here in North Carolina.
North Carolina. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I said, I need a job that helps me learn that. And I started looking around, and I found an organization called the North Carolina Institute of Medicine that had a job opening and said, huh, that looks interesting. They cover a lot of topics.
That sounds big.
They connect with a lot of people. They're, you know, really, you know, there's a wide breadth of work, a wide breadth of topics. And, you know, I thought that exposure would be incredibly helpful for me. Plus, it seemed like a really great mission, you know, to bring people together and say, let's talk about the challenges in our state and let's come up with consensus on what the solutions to those challenges can be.
You know, that is brilliant. And we're going to talk in just a moment about, like, what is the NCIO? And what's involved, but what I know already is what a brilliant place to come and get that kind of on-the-job education about a number of topics. I mean, we're here at UNC. I shout out the School of Public Health, which I love, but it just feels like everyone interested in healthcare and health politics and the infrastructure needs to do time at the NCIOM just to learn, but I need to allow you to explain what it is.
Well, you mentioned, you know, the a few of the different projects that we have or that I have worked on, and I remember my very first week on the job, I went to a meeting that was about food insecurity. Mm-hmm. The next day, I went to a meeting that was about rural health access to health care. The next day that I went to a meeting about child maltreatment prevention and public health approaches to that. So it was just, you know, within 72 hours, all of these things. And so it was amazing.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. So let's tell, so that way we go from a sort of an inner conversation of like, hey, I know what this is. Tell our audience members, what is the North Carolina Institute of Medicine? It sounds impressive. There's a lot of funky words in there that make you assume you know what it is, but what is it really? And tell us more about who it is, what it is, what it does.
Great. So we're sort of a funny organization in terms of where we sit. We're called, it's a quasi-governmental organization. Mm. And what I mean by that, so we were chartered by the General Assembly in 1983. So we've been around a little bit over 40 years. And our mission is to be concerned with the health of the people of North Carolina. Mm. And we do that in a lot of different ways. So we provide analysis of health issues. Mm. We provide data and research. And we do a lot of convening. So we bring people together to talk about what those issues are, what they're experiencing, either in their work. So we bring healthcare providers, administrators, local public health workers, people who work in healthcare or the health system in some way or another. And then we also bring people together with lived experience of these various health issues too, because we're not only looking at quantitative data, but we really want to understand how people are experiencing these health challenges themselves and how those experiences might be different for different people depending on where they live, what they do, what their background is, because having that understanding of why they're facing those challenges definitely helps us understand what solutions are already happening and how we can spread those and expand those and provide more resources for the things that work.
We are going to go so much deeper into that in a second, but I want to go back to a word you said, because this is where it's also selfish for me, because I talk about the NCIOM and my work now directly links, Michelle knows, to the Institute of Medicine. And when I talk about it, there is this word quasi. Uh-huh. And so for people who are like, what does it mean to be a quasi-governmental organization?
Yeah. I'm not sure I can completely answer that.
Hey, nobody's listening. We're not on the air.
What it means. Yeah. So to me, what that means is that we serve the government. We do provide analysis to the General Assembly, to the governor's office, to state agencies, to other sort of governmental entities. But we also have a much broader mission than that. It also has some nitty gritty about, we get a little bit of money from the state, but only a little bit. About 10-15% of our annual budget comes from the state in a given year. So the wide majority of it is coming from other sources.
Is any of it federal?
Not directly.
Good question.
And I don't know. I don't want to jump on where you might be going with that in terms of some of the changes.
Just was wondering the budget.
Yeah, sure. So we do have some projects that are funded by the state, where the state receives federal money for those initiatives. Mm-hmm. So there are some things that we're not getting direct federal contracts, but there might be some implication. Yeah.
So it is interesting, and I was playing with my mic, and now I made it a lot louder for myself. When we think about who does fund it, because I want to go into, there's so many different things to go into, but so you do this government connection, and because I want to get into, well, what's going on in my mind is, and do they listen to you? So what's fascinating is you, and maybe we've jumped ahead a little bit, but so you do report to, as you said, the General Assembly, state offices, the governor, other agencies, and they give you a little bit of money. So we'll take a pause on whether they listen to you, because I know that's something I want to jump into a little bit after we talk about the types of things you do. But so generally then your funding, does it come from where? Foundations, other organizations? I know where I used to work actually gave some money, a nonprofit organization, towards one of the initiatives looking at health aging issues. But
that's right. So you mentioned a lot of different sources, and the answer to all of those is yes. We get money
from
all of those.
Vanilla, chocolate, right. Strawberry, yes.
Right. And sometimes, you know, in some of the background questions you gave me, said, how do these projects come about is one of the questions you had. And so
it's my selfishness. Yeah. I really was curious.
Well, and I can jump into that because some of that is about funding, right? Mm-hmm. So projects and task forces and other projects that we do come to us in a lot of different ways. Occasionally, we are named in a piece of legislation where they'll say the NCIOM should study XYZ and deliver a report to the General Assembly. That happens sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it also happens where the Department of Health and Human Services, for instance, will be named and say they need to produce a report or a study or do a task force. And sometimes they will turn to us as a contracted partner to do that for them, right?
That makes sense.
That's great because sometimes that comes with funding, but sometimes it doesn't. You know, there are times when we, are approached by a state agency and they say, we want some help doing this project, and then we have to fundraise for it as well. So we might get some funding from the state for that and then have to go to private philanthropy and advocacy organizations, other sources, and try to build the funding for that. One example, I was just going to say, we also have a lot of partners. You know, as you can imagine, we do a lot of, since we do have so many different topics that we cover, we have a lot of people that we know, a lot of partners that support us in this work, that participate in our work. And sometimes they will come to us and they'll say, hey, we've been encountering this issue. This is something that is, you know, something that's really bubbling up as a problem. And we think that this is a topic that would be really helped by an NCIOM task force or an NCIOM process where we can identify what the right solutions are. Mm-hmm. An example I'll give of that is we're currently running, and we just had the first meeting last week, of a task force on veterans health.
Okay.
And we were actually approached by our partners at AARP North Carolina about 2 years ago or so. So it just got launched last week, and we started talking about this 2 years ago.
You're really fun to follow or interesting to follow on AARP and AARP, on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. And then I follow, I think, the Institute itself. And so, yeah, I'm always seeing cool things that are happening. And I think I saw the posts about the veterans health.
Well, that came to us because those partners, AARP does a lot of work with veterans.
Right. Yes.
And they were working on producing some resources for folks on new eligibility rules at the federal level about the benefits that people were eligible for.
We've done shows on it here. I've done shows the serious illness, and I cannot wrap my mind around it. So I just love that it's complicated.
It's very complicated. And what we, they said we're hearing about issues about care coordination between, services provided at the VA, services provided outside of the VA, trying to make sure that people understand what they're eligible for across all these different services, trying to make sure that providers who are in the community have a good understanding of veterans' needs and, cultural competency around veteran issues and things like that. So they came to us and they said, we would love to talk about that. And I said, that sounds
great,
fascinating and very timely. And so we started having a lot of conversations with, providers at the VA, other people who really have a lot of good knowledge and expertise about these issues, with veterans themselves as well, trying to, make sure that we were understanding their experience of, some of the things that we were talking about. And we figured out who the funding sources needed to be for that, and we are very grateful to have funding from AARP as well as from the Department of Health and Human Services Division of Mental Health for that work.
Oh, great.
So it's wonderful. So that, it took 2 years to get that off the ground, which does happen because we have to do our due diligence, make sure that we understand the issues, make sure that there are a lot of partners and sort of the right people at the table who are willing to come together and have those conversations.
Mm. Well, and I think maybe then it's a good time to dive into the process, because I would, from what I know, a lot of people get involved in these task forces. Mm-hmm. So in addition to gathering all the money, it's gathering, being able to say you've got a critical mass of smart people and engaged people willing to come together and dedicate some time. Mm-hmm. So either both you need the capacity with your team, and then you need the capacity and interest of all the folks. So is that part? And then That's also a long-winded way of saying, tell us about the process that happens. Yeah. But I know just enough to be dangerous.
Right.
Like, no.
Because I was wondering, that are there proposals? Are there things that you have to submit?
There are, yes. And that depends a little bit on the funding. So, you know, we got to write grant applications and all of that. But we also have to make sure that, you know, as you said, Heather, it's a big time commitment for people to participate. We ask them to come together for several hours, you know, once or twice a month, maybe even more than that. We ask them to, you know, help us with writing things, to help us identify the right research that we're bringing into things. So we want to make sure that we're making the process worth their time, right? And so, you know, when we start a project, the very first thing that we do is we have a planning phase. And by planning, you know, that's logistics. You know, when are we going to have the meetings? How long are they going to last? Are we going to serve coffee? You know, those kind of questions. And then we also have questions about how are we, what is the scope that we want to make sure that we're focused on? Because when you say something like veterans health or serious illness care, it could expand to fill the world, right? And so we want to make sure that we are narrowing down enough to the key issues where we're going to really be able to talk about them thoroughly enough and talk about things that have solutions that we can identify that are really going to make a difference.
Which in itself is complicated, because I know, and I've been in the audience and in the, or in the surrounding world, and like around the healthy aging issues, and and you have people that are the what about, like, and I can do this too, if you know, hey, you're doing this, but what about this issue? What about this issue? What about this issue? So we all need to be herded in and saying, okay, here are the four issues that we're really going to dive into, and we recognize these other issues are important. They're going to be outside the scope of this.
That's right.
So I would think that also takes a level of diplomacy and thoughtfulness.
That is correct. And sometimes those are issues that we don't cover because they have been covered sufficiently elsewhere, right? And we know that people are very interested in them. There are still issues that are really relevant, but that we don't necessarily feel like our process is going to add a lot to, you know, the conversation or the action, right? So we do that. We figure out what are those scoping questions so that we can come to a task force and say, these are the key issues. These are the ones that we're going to focus on and really drill down our process so that we are focused on those things. We do a variety of different, you know, sort of logistical parts of our process. Sometimes if we have a broad scope, we will say, I've got 60 people on this task force, and it's all these perspectives that we need. So we need a group that big. But, you know, Heather, you might not have the expertise that Alicia has, and we might not need both of your expertise at all times, right? So we might say, we're going to have work groups that are that are a little bit more specific of a focus, something like
Makes
that.
Sense.
Yeah, so we'll do that. And that depends, you know, and occasionally we'll get half or two-thirds of the way through a task force process and say, geez, we didn't know that we needed a work group on this, but this has bubbled up.
This is coming up.
Yeah, so we try to have the flexibility to be able to pull that together as we need to.
Well, and so you do this process, and folks come together, and I was, funny, years ago, you don't know this, there it was one of the aging-related ones, and I really wanted to be on it. Like, I was hoping to make one of it, because it is honor, it is acknowledging people in their expertise and their thought leadership to be asked to serve on, and I remember my boss was able to go on instead, but even though I did so many community outreach, I was like, I want to be on the group, but it was great. You got the big fish. I mean, I was a nice medium-sized fish, but so you bring these folks together, and the process of then what happens and making the recommendations, and so.
Great. So we really start out with wanting to listen to the people that we have brought together. And so, you know, the first couple of times we get together, it's a little bit of level setting. We have people come in and talk about data that informs the issue, talk about, you know, how North Carolina is faring in whatever that we're talking about, making sure that we have, you know, just a clear understanding of those issues. We also delve into the questions of what do you know is going on? You know, if we say, you know, we're hearing about all of these things, what are the things that you are working on that relate to these issues. And that helps us get a sense of the landscape. When we pull people together, you know, we've done a lot of background work, but we might not know, you know, about something that's happening, you know, in a smaller town in the east, mm-hmm. eastern part of the state, for instance. So when we're trying to have that, you know, diversity of perspectives, we're looking at different regions, different types of communities, really trying to understand the, all of the different facets there. So we ask people, what's going on? What are you working on in this area? And what can we pull from that? That is either this is something that I think is really working in my community mm-hmm. that other communities can learn from, or that we need, you know, additional resources in order to do that better, or to you know, expand it across the state. So we really try to have that sense of things. Another question that we often ask at one of those first meetings is, if you had a magic wand to solve this problem, what would you ask for? And it's always fascinating to me because people will often say, well, I can't. You know, this is what we need, but we can't do it because, whatever. And I say, okay, we're going to talk about the barriers next.
Yes.
But right
we're magic wanding it.
Right. If we're magic wanding it, what would be the thing that we need? Mm-hmm. And then we can talk about, okay, but that might not work because of this. But if you can have that a little bit as your North Star, that as we're having these conversations, we're going to try to get as close to that magic wand solution as we can. I know that sounds awfully optimistic, and we don't always get there, I will say, but we're trying to get there.
Because it was, and I've had that, I wonder if my colleague who uses it learned it from the IOM.
Or we might have stolen it from them. That's totally possible.
But it is interesting because, what's nice about that is you can get past the people who immediately will come up with all the barriers. Mm-hmm. We don't have the funding. We don't have that. Have you ever had an issue where, we'll get to the recommendations, where you all look at it and they're like, there's absolutely nothing we can do about this issue. I mean, there's always something. Like, I think about my magic wand with my own caregiving mm-hmm. situation. And my big thing is it would have been very different if it wasn't during a pandemic.
Sure,
like,
absolutely.
There's nothing to do about that one. But have you had situations where, I'm thinking about these big things, so I don't want to go on a tangent of climate change. But mm-hmm. if it's like, oh, okay.
I mean, yes, that absolutely happens. And, you know, you're asking about process. At some point, we all sit down and we make everybody go through really, really detailed worksheets where, you know, we're talking about what are the resources needed to make this happen? Is that money? Is that people? Is that training? Is that 10 more universities in the state? You know, what it could be a huge range of things. What are the barriers to making any of those resources happen? Mm-hmm. And what is the will and the feasibility? And so mm-hmm. sometimes that can be political will. Do we think that there's, you know, opportunity, you know, in a political path? Sometimes that's, you know, community will or mm-hmm. something like that. When we talk about feasibility, again, sometimes that's, you know, feasibility of getting the right people on board to support it. Sometimes that's feasibility in terms of the resources that are needed. And we kind of rank things that way. And we say, you know, if this is something that because of all of this laundry list of reasons we don't think is going to happen, maybe we're not going to put our energy behind that. Maybe we mm-hmm. can find the things that we think will be more feasible and that can actually make an impact and get us a little closer to that magic wand solution.
All right. So then I'm going through the process. You bring people together. You hear their experiences. You make, and I've known because I've read some of your reports. So talk about the process of coming down and making reports that have a list of recommendations. Mm-hmm. Is that generally the next step in this process?
It is. And that's, it's usually somewhere between a half and two thirds of the way through a process, which is, you know, usually about a year, maybe 15 months or so.
Oh, that's another question. How long do these go for?
Yeah, about 12 to 15 months.
It varies a little bit,
but that's probably about the standard.
Can you help me understand? You might get, email and how many of these things are you getting? Are you getting like, hey, this organization wants you to do this, and this one, are you being pulled with so many that you have people on staff working on so many different projects?
Good question.
That is a great question. We don't actually have that many specific requests in that way. What we get is a lot of wanting to have conversations with our team and wanting us to help, you know, facilitate conversations with other people too. And sometimes, you know, something bubbles up where we say that's going to be a task force or that's going to be one
just
of our major projects. Right. But often it comes from listening, not even a direct, you know, we need to do this project, but just as we are listening to these conversations, as we're attending other people's events, as we're reading other people's research and we're saying, hey, this is really something that I think is important. And then again, then we'll start that process of talking to a bunch of people and saying, hey, is this something that we think could work
discovery.
For this?
Oh, yeah. So discovery could be part of just being there.
That's right. Right.
So at any one time, do you have like, I keep saying like a lot, but two or three task forces going on or one task force and then you have a bunch of discovery, like what is the capacity?
That's about
there?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So usually around one to three big task forces at a time and then anywhere between, I don't know, three or five other projects that are a little separate from a task force. Yeah. We do a lot of what we call action teams where they are shorter processes, more targeted in scope, where we might say we want to look at this one policy and what are considerations for the state in implementing that one policy.
Oh, so it's not like a full task force on a big population issue. It's, hey, we're specifically looking at this one.
Yep.
And the reason why I ask is because, again, I follow you all. I follow you and I follow the NCIOM. And I'm thinking even in the last week or two, I feel like I have seen posts on veterans health, children's health, and nursing.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah, and I didn't even prepare for this interview. I'm just saying.
That's just in the air,
I barely prepared. I was like, I know Michelle.
Right.
But were those are in different, some one's ending, one's starting, one's
in
the middle.
Are they ongoing?
Right.
They ongoing?
I would love to talk just a minute about the nursing work, if that, I think maybe
you
your
have plenty
audience
of minutes.
Help.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's actually a task force that we completed a little over a year ago. That was called the Task Force on the Future of the Nursing Workforce. And that work came about, again, because we were sort of seeing the writing on the wall. We were talking to a lot of our partners about the number of nurses in our state, the number that are coming through the education system, through universities, through community colleges. And we were looking at the demographics in our state and saying, who actually is going to need this care? You all know better than anybody, I think, about, you know, some of the needs that our state has as our population gets older, as, you know, people are facing different kinds of illnesses and needing different kinds of care. We have a lot of partners that pull together data on the healthcare workforce, specifically on nursing. The SHEP Center out of UNC is a fantastic resource there.
We have Mark Holmes come on.
Yes, Holmes and Aaron Freyer are both incredible resources on that. That's right. And you know, we're very, very fortunate as a state to have that center here because the information that they provide to us, to all of our partners, it's just incredibly helpful. But a lot of the data that was coming out of that work, you know, was looking at just the changes in the nursing profession. Even before COVID, we saw that there was, you know, a shortage in the number of nurses that we really need in the state. We know that COVID exacerbated, you know, people leaving the profession. Sometimes people just leaving their job and going to another one, but sometimes people leaving the profession altogether. So we wanted to look at, you know, what are the reasons behind that? What's going on there? And what we found, there's a lot of things. It's not, you know, just one or two, but, you know, there are things around burnout and mental health challenges.
Yes.
One of the big things that we heard in that task force in particular was around the experience of nurses in their jobs of bullying, of racism, of, you know, other kinds of harassment within their
violence.
Jobs.
Violence.
That's right.
I was watching The Pit, which is actually, and people are saying it's pretty, and this issue of nurse violence from other patients is an issue.
Not that this is a commercial for The Pit, but I love The Pit.
It was so good.
And here's why.
I just binged it. I avoided it for so long. I don't know why. And it was so good.
Well, and one of the reasons that I love it is because it takes place in the emergency department. And so it's, you know, you're looking at all the clinical stuff that's coming in, but they do an incredible job of saying, here's all the social drivers of all these things.
They,
and that's what we look at NCIM too.
So many issues, these larger social issues. They just did a phenomenal job. Listeners, we wish you were with us in our adorable studio because we have friends visiting us. So because we're at the library, it's really sweet. We have people outside the window waving to us. So what's really interesting, and I'm going to take a quick tangent because I'm going to do a little personal name dropping and pride. So 20 years ago, about 20 years ago, the National Institute of Medicine, which then got renamed years later to the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine or math or something.
Science, engineering, math, I think. Science, engineering, medicine? Something like that.
I mean,
we are not directly affiliated with them, although we do partner with them on some things.
You do partner, but so when you were talking about the nursing, the 20 years ago or so was the first future, I think it was the first future of the nursing workforce. Mm-hmm. And you know who was on that task force? My sweet father, Alicia, who you adore, who turns 88 tomorrow. It's his birthday. We've had my dad on the show.
Oh, happy birthday. Oh, my goodness.
And he's
so cool. That's why we get along. Mine was yesterday.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Whose was yesterday?
Mine.
Oh, my gosh. You always keep it from me. And I had a present for you,
dad,
too.
Her dad. I love it.
Yeah, he was on our second or third show talking about his health policy.
Back here.
Oh, wonderful.
But anyway, so yeah, just so you know, he was on the National back in the day, the IOM on the Future of Nursing. So sorry for that tangent. And I had a present for you.
We
got to
get him back here. He is phenomenal.
So, okay, so really important work. And so you're deciding these different topics. They're at different phases. Even though you finished that work in the Future of Nursing a year ago, you're still promoting the action
That's
plans
correct.
From it.
Yep.
You're starting on the Veterans Health, the Children's Health one. I know you ended not too long, but you're just
that's right.
Well, doing the report.
So we do a few different things around children's health regularly. And
I was going to say,
So one of the things that we that we've done since 1997 is the Child Health Report Card. So we publish that in partnership with NC Child, which is a child advocacy organization, and we really look at several indicators of children's health, and we look at it right now, and we look at a trend from a few years ago. And then we give a grade to all those indicators. And it's nice because it's very easily understood. We can say we have an A here, we have an F here, right? And so that's something that we, really try to publicize too, because it's something that people really find valuable.
Interesting. It could be more complex, and other groups are doing it a little bit, but any chance of doing one about older adults? I mean, there are other groups that do report cards, but any interest in doing an older adult report card?
We have not talked about that, but I really love that idea. I think that's a great idea.
I mean, there are a few groups that do it. ARP has one. Then there's another group that does it. Ah, gosh. And Michelle's about to be a graduate student in the same program I did, a great doctoral program, and I remember referencing it during that. But so there are some report cards out there.
That's right.
That would be neat. Let's talk about that.
I would love to talk about that. I think that's a great idea.
We have a lot that this all started because Michelle and I are like, we need to get together and do some strategizing. I'm like, well, let's talk. Let's come on the radio show. So, and then this will get to even the way that I've been connected. So you do these recommendations. So this is a loaded question because she knows also where I'm going with this. So you do these recommendations. So these reports come out and you have a series of like, this should be done. Then what happens? And link it back to that first question I was going to ask earlier on when you talked about being a quasi-governmental and you have these government where you're providing information. Because part of where I'm going to go is you make all these recommendations, especially for our government partners. Are they like, oh, thanks, Michelle and NCIOM. We'll make this change now because you told us that we probably should. Or what happens?
That is the
how loaded
ideal
is that question?
Well, so I will say, if we've done our job right, we are never going to somebody at the end of a process and saying, hey, this is brand new information for you that we were talking about all these things and now you have to do them. That's not, we don't approach what we call implementing organizations at the end of a process. We want those organizations involved at every step of the way. Sometimes they're, our really direct partners, our funders, on our planning committees and all of that, because they actually want the recommendations. They want the consensus process. Mm-hmm. And that's fantastic.
And that will help them decide, and this is work I did years ago. It helps them decide their philanthropic priorities.
That's right.
A group of experts did a consensus-driven report. This is where we need more investment in that's programs, right. and then they're like, great, we have the money, help us think through where's the best place to put it. Love that.
That's right. So, and sometimes there's, you know, our process helps put, what's the sort of bad phrase to use, but helps put like meat on the bones of a suggestion to say, okay, we're going to do this thing. And if we're going to do this thing, here's all the other things that we have to be thinking about when we do that. So sometimes we call those, you know, considerations for implementation, that if you're going to pass this policy, here's all the other you know, ripple effects and things that are going to come from that. So that happens. You know, if we haven't partner directly with an organization on a process, we do, you know, still try to have them on the task force. If we think you have an organization that might that might be named in a recommendation or that might be a part of this conversation, we do our best to make sure that we're identifying who those organizations are at the beginning so that the conversation is all with them,
like
right?
With nutrition, if you're like, hey, if a bunch of congregate meal sites should do this, well, then they need to be a part of
exactly.
the conversation.
And then they're the ones that have the insight and the expertise on those questions about feasibility and barriers and all of that kind of thing. So it's really important that those are our partners from the beginning.
So you have these recommendations, and is there ever pushback or complexity and well, I'll just talk. So my job and my work is connected to the serious illness task force that was done in 2019 and 2020. And it was great. I got involved 2 years later, so I wasn't a part of that original task force. But there's a series of recommendations. And some recommendations are for legislative changes to make it easier for people to fill out their advanced directives, to reduce some of the administrative burdens that we're one of only three states that have these burdens. Like, and I think at the time it was considered, the sense I have from others is that, oh, okay, this shouldn't be that big a deal to sort of revise a statute to make it. We're now 6 years in. We've gone through three, what do we call them, two-year sessions of the General Assembly? Do we call them the biennial or two-year
That's
sessions?
That's right, yeah.
And it keeps not passing.
Right.
This little baby bill, it keeps changing. When the Senate bill's 66, then it was 147. Now it's currently HB 349. And so I lovingly give not Michelle a hard time, but when I look at it, I'm like, when I look at the task force recommendations, it said implementing group, the NC General Assembly.
Yep.
And it was like, well, there also needs to be a group that's responsible for continuously advocating, making sure it's being reintroduced. And then it's not this consensus report.
Yeah.
And it's not passing. And it's a basic thing. And so that got me thinking about, are there other things that it's like, oh, well, we just, like, this seemed like this was going to pass, or a lot of other things can't happen until this happens. And then you run into, so clearly I have my own, you know, I've had my own experiences. So I'm always curious when there's legislative things, when there's these recommendations that everyone's agreed. Yeah. Right. Because these are consensus documents.
Right. So, NCIOM does not do advocacy, so we won't go to the General Assembly and say, you should vote on this, or you should draft this piece of legislation and pass it. We're not going to say that. What we will do is we will say, we convened this task force, and we looked at this data and this information and these perspectives on this issue, and the consensus that the task force came to was that this should be a policy that you make or change or pass or write, you know, whatever it is. But you're right. We don't really do the work of continuing that. What we do try to do, and again, if we've done our job right, we have these partners that can do that, is we say, who can do that work? Who can do that advocacy? Who can take this forward? Maybe it's not, you know, advocacy or lobbying in that way, but maybe it's, you know, monitoring the implementation and saying, and doing that, you know, continual landscape analysis of who are the new players? What is the new context? And what we really try to do is sort of pass the baton to those organizations following the end of a task force process. Sometimes that's formalized in a you know, a contract where we say task force is phase one and phase two is for you to do. Sometimes it's more informal than that, where we, you know, work to identify, you know, who are the organizations that can take that stuff forward.
And I think the North Carolina Serious Illness Coalition, did that become a more informal one or more formal? I don't think we had a formal
So there was there was at least one. There might have been two or three recommendations directly from that task force for the creation of the Serious Illness Coalition.
Oh yeah, I've been
right.
Writing it.
And then all the stuff that y'all should do, right? So that's all in there.
I guess that's why it's formalized, because we were written
so.
In there,
yeah,
in the task force,
right.
And there were five things assigned to us,
right?
But the group just sort of it was more the contract, and I've been the one to use that language.
Right.
You know, the work we're doing when I was at the General Assembly a few months ago was saying, hey, this is consistent with the finding of recommendation 2.5 through 4.6 that talked about. So while I can see why you didn't do it and say the NCIOM recommends this, you didn't have to, because it's literally, you did. It's like literally a recommendation.
Right.
So you give the language to those of us who are there and saying, this consensus group panel, here's specifically the recommendation, and this bill would address that recommendation.
One thing I will say that we have started doing more in recent years, which I think is really great progress in terms of our role. You mentioned seeing the nursing workforce information from the task force that finished a year ago. One of the things that we are doing is reconvening a lot of groups and saying, okay, it's been a year or 2 years, whatever it is, what's happening? What are you working on? Mm-hmm. Where has there been, new policies that are impacting your ability to make these changes? Are there new things that we didn't even talk about in the task force, but there's new federal legislation or there's new, something else that we want to address and figure out how does that have impact on the things that we identified as the key issues? So, that's also another way to make sure that we are continuing to bring people together, bring attention to the issues, bring attention to the solutions, and help identify, what other things we might need to do.
That's good.
I want to do that with you. Let's plan on that. Because we hit our 5-year anniversary of the Serious Illness Coalition in February, and there may be things that, especially those things
revisited,
that we're hitting roadblocks that we can't seem to, a group of volunteers and advocates can't really do, but some of the more structural things.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one of the examples that I use all the time from the Serious Illness Report was, so I think we had the last meeting of that task force in January 2020.
You did?
We issued the report in April of 2020 after we did all the writing. Everybody knows what was going on in the spring of 2020. Mm-hmm. And one of the, sort of interesting recommendations that we talked about throughout that task force process was the opportunities for telehealth in improving serious illness care. And I remember, because I was the project director on that work, and I remember facilitating a lot of conversations that were about, okay, well, yes, telehealth is a wonderful solution, but it's really difficult because of XYZ. And it's we're having trouble paying for it. And we're having trouble with broadband, and we're having trouble, there's all kinds of barriers, right? And people saying, it's going to take years to be able to do this. We do think that it's where we need to go, but it's going to take a really long time. Most of those things were done by May of that year.
Yeah.
Because of the context, right? And the change and the real necessity for those things was what was able to make some of those things happen really quickly.
Yes.
Some of those things have stuck around, some have not, but we are very cognizant of the ways that other broader things going on have an impact on our ability to make changes.
And it is amazing when all of these concerns, and then all of a sudden this big thing came out, and then all of a sudden, I'm not going to say all the concerns melted away, but by May and April and by June of 2020, when I was a full-time caregiver of my mom and it got really complicated, a lot of her doctor's appointments became telehealth.
That's right.
So all of a sudden, it was like, like we see in any emergency, the administrivia and some of the abstract barriers just drop down.
That's right.
We're going to get this done.
That's right.
So great example. We have just a few minutes left, and we could just keep talking. But one of the things that I definitely want to make sure that we talk about is, how can the public get involved? And especially in terms of the resources, because it's a treasure trove of information, your website. And so talk about different ways that folks can get involved, or they can at least learn and benefit from some of the work that has been done, or a lot of the work that's been done.
Yeah, thank you. So I say, we talked about our task forces and that we invite a bunch of people to participate as task force members. Those meetings are all open to the public. So if somebody wants to attend attend a meeting and listen, and listen to the conversation and learn a little bit more about the issue, or, you know, understand how that issue is relevant to their work or their lives. We absolutely welcome that. So that is absolutely something that, you know, that is a great opportunity. In terms of resources and things, we do have a lot of reports and issue briefs and one pagers and all of that.
They're good.
Thank you.
I like them.
We do actually, one of the things that we are really trying to improve our capacity to do is to try to do more of that, to have more resources. I think, you know, we always have big, long reports, and then we have little, more digestible ways to get that information across. But, you know, we do, you know, always welcome input on, hey, this would be really helpful if you did a one pager on this particular recommendation
get
or whatever.
Get you some interns and ChatGPT.
That's right.
That's
right.
You'll get those done quickly. I have a group doing that now.
Yeah.
So folks can come. What is your website? Can you add that there?
It is www.ncium.org.
See, so specific. North Carolina Institute of Medicine. I mean, specific and easy.
And I have not mentioned, we also published the North Carolina Medical Journal.
Oh, I thought goodness. That and I realized I didn't.
Yep. Yeah. Which you can access through NCIOM.org. You can also Google North Carolina Medical Journal, and that comes up right away, too. And that comes out 4 times a year. And that is original research and commentaries and sort of invited perspective pieces on lots of different health issues. So we recently, our most recent issue came out about 2 weeks ago, and that was on pharmacy and the role of pharmacists in healthcare. The one before that was around response to Hurricane Helene and looking at, you know, community needs and sort of public health outcomes of Helene and the community initiatives for response and relief.
And in your crazy over just fabulousness, aren't you editor of the North Carolina Medical Journal?
That's right. Yep.
Yeah, I realized that I hadn't put that on there. I'm like, that's a whole other...
I am an editor. We have an editor-in-chief who is not me. But we have scientific editors who contribute a lot of fantastic expertise in medicine and public health and, you know, academic writing and everything as well. So,
well, listeners, you can see why this was such a great get to have Michelle Reese, the president and CEO of the North Carolina Institute of Medicine, come on the Aging Well Together show. There's a lot more for us to talk about. Please make sure this is your first of many visits. Seriously, if there's ever a time, and we didn't even get to, we kind of touched on the edges of it, all the different reports that impact older adults. We did do serious illness, and I know there's a healthy aging. Go to the website, NCIOM.org. And so just know, if you ever want to come, now that we've done the general, we could just do a deep dive and talk nothing about older adults or talk nothing about nursing and or medical journal. Like, you are now a friend to the show.
Wonderful. Thank you. I mean, this has been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah. And isn't that super
you can
fun?
Tell I'm very excited about sharing what we do, because I do think it is impactful in the ways that we're able to look at so many different challenges. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I love about our vantage point is we can say there's all these challenges. Sometimes there's common solutions, and there's often a lot of connections between the work we can all do together. Mm-hmm. So, and that's what it takes.
So exciting. Michelle Reese, thank you so much. Alicia, my friend, thank you so much. Happy after birthday to our listeners. We always appreciate you joining us. WCOM-FM, Chapel Hill, Carrboro. We love the new studio. And lastly, to our sponsors, the Orange County Department on Aging. This is all because of you. And so we will be back on next week. Thank you, everyone. We'll be right back.